The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are today making our second pass through the July 3rd, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. And we will start today with two shorter main stories that we didn't get last week. Iran plays hardball. The West push to secure a landmark nuclear deal with Tehran hit a potential roadblock this week when Iran's supreme leader effectively undercut negotiation days before the June 30th deadline by ruling out a number of conditions agreed to during previous talks. Under the interim deal, unveiled in April, economic sanctions on Iran were to be phased out after Tehran allowed nuclear inspections and agreed to freeze some enrichment for a decade. But in a defiant speech on state television, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has the ultimate say on any deal, refused to dismantle the country's nuclear infrastructure unless sanctions were lifted first, and insisted that freezing of Iran's research and development for 10 years was not acceptable. The inspection of Iranian military sites, added Khamenei, also was out of the question, as is one of our red lines. Khamenei's speech was certainly theatrical, said Steve Levine in QZ.com. But it was also a psy war at its most transparent. Everybody knows that Supreme Leader's biggest priority is staying in power and that crippling sanctions are making his position increasingly unstable. Around 57% of Iranians now support a nuclear deal. The advantage clearly lies with President Obama if he knows how to use it. If only, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Unfortunately, we all know what happens when Tehran says no to this administration. Obama simply surrenders. That's what happened when Iran refused to give up all enrichment and when it refused to dismantle its centrifuges. Obama is desperate to make a deal, any deal with Tehran, but if he agrees to lift sanctions while Iran continues its nuclear work, he'll be capitulating to terms any self-respecting leader would walk away from. If the West does refuse Iran's latest demand, said Michael Singh in WSJ.com, Khamenei may settle for Plan B, dragging out negotiations even further. The U.S. and its allies aren't about to bomb Iran or impose more sanctions if Khamenei refuses to submit by the deadline. Were those real threats? Iran would have greater incentive to negotiate more seriously. I'll wager that come June 30th, just as on countless other occasions during 2 years of supposedly groundbreaking talks, yet another deadline passes unmet. U.S. data hack grows. Federal officials said this week that a suspected Chinese cyber attack targeting U.S. government workers may have been far worse than first acknowledged, with as many as 18 million personnel records compromised over the past year, four times the number given in an earlier estimate. Hackers reportedly accessed confidential information on current, former, and prospective government employees in two separate breaches of the Office of Personnel Management's files, swiping data like Social Security numbers, addresses, and birth dates, as well as security clearance forms that reveal information about the family, friends, and medical histories of military and intelligence personnel. The Chinese government has denied any involvement in the attacks. OPM Director Catherine Archuleta also deflected responsibility for the breach at a heated Senate subcommittee hearing this week, saying, if there is anyone to blame, it is the perpetrators. The Chinese now have a blackmail instruction manual for millions of targets, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Everyone, from the cabinet officials to U.S. spies, is vulnerable, along with anyone remotely connected to them. What if China were to sell this data treasure trove to one of its rogue allies? The Obama administration may have allowed a cyber 9/11 at home. These acts are serious, but they were acts of espionage, not war, said Henry Farrell in the Washington Post. Stealing personal information doesn't disable vital communications or power systems, and it will have to have no direct consequences for American defense. And, of course, the U.S. conducts plenty of its own cyber spying. To equate these hacks with a military-style attack would be to admit the nation is at war all the time against allies as well as adversaries. But it's long past time to fix the problem, said David Auerbach in Slate.com. The government needs a cybersecurity surge like the efforts that rescued healthcare.gov after its disastrous rollout. The administration should deputize outside experts to immediately audit computer systems in every agency, brutally assess their failings, and shore up their defenses. Unless drastic changes are made, breaches will keep happening. We turn now to the columns, take in a few more of them this week than we usually do. Starting in the U.S., back the Kurds, not Baghdad. It's time to rethink the war on ISIS, said Charles Krauthammer. For too long, we've put the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad at the center of our policy and made it the channel for all military aid. We have nothing to show for this strategy. In Fallujah, Mosul, and Ramadi, the Iraqi army fled when faced with an inferior force from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, leaving behind stacks of American weapons and vehicles. We can train them forever, but Iraqi forces clearly don't want to fight. And why should they? They are led by commanders who are corrupt, sectarian, and incompetent. So let's abandon our outdated fealty to Baghdad, which is now largely a tool of Tehran, and redirect our efforts to friendly forces deeply committed to the fight, beginning with the Kurds. Despite receiving only a trickle of American weapons from Baghdad, the Kurds have so far taken back more than 500 towns from ISIS this year. Imagine what they could achieve with more U.S. training, equipment, and air support. Defeating ISIS doesn't require an American invasion, but it does mean supporting our few genuine allies on the ground. When doctors scam the system. American politics is haunted by the mythological specter of the welfare queen, said David Graham. Despite Clinton-era welfare reforms and a growing list of state restrictions on how public benefits can be used, Americans remain convinced that vast numbers of undeserving citizens are swindling the system. There is welfare fraud, but the biggest perpetrators are health care professionals. The Department of Justice announced last week that 243 people had been arrested and charged with stealing $712 million from Medicare. 46 of those arrested were doctors, nurses, pharmacy owners, and other medical professionals who billed the government for fraudulent therapy sessions and prescriptions. One Los Angeles doctor allegedly prescribed 1,000 medically unnecessary power wheelchairs at a cost of $23 million. A doctor in Michigan is accused of handing out addictive narcotics in exchange for his patients' personal information to generate further false billings. These cases aren't rarities. Fraud likely consumes around 10% of Medicare's $500 billion annual budget. So forget welfare queens. It's the crooked doctors we need to really worry about. Political dynasties are harmless. It's understandable that many Americans feel troubled by the prospect of another Bush versus Clinton presidential battle, said Jamel Bowie. But a Jeb-Hillary matchup would not spell the death of our democracy. Political dynasties are a recurring part of American life, from the Adamses to the Harrisons to the Roosevelts to the Kennedys. Sure, this nepotism doesn't exactly square with our country's delusions of meritocracy, but does it really do any harm? History suggests that dynastic politicians don't, as a rule, make worse decisions than outsiders. As for the fear that Bush and Clinton represent more of the same, that's a lazy mischaracterization. George W. Bush was a very different president from his father, after all, and the introspective Jeb would surely not be the same kind of president as his brother. Ultimately, the identity of the president matters less than we care to admit. Had Clinton won in 2008, she'd likely have employed most of the same Democratic political advisors and policymakers as President Obama, and probably would have pushed a similar agenda. Granted, the aesthetics of another Clinton or Bush presidency don't look great, but optics have little bearing on what either candidate will do in office. Columns from Europe now. This from Greece. Hounded to death by creditors. The Western leaders who are insisting that Greece continue to slash benefits and services are literally killing us, said Pantelis Boukalis. The suicide rate here has soared 35% since 2010 and is worse not among teens or pensioners, but among the most productive age group. And it's no wonder. The entire nation has been hanging on every successive pronouncement from international leaders, parsing each word to determine whether we will get relief from the crushing austerity plans that have pushed so many of us into poverty. Our emotions are yanked from up to down, from warm to cold, from hope to disappointment, and back again. The suicides are the collateral damage of a kind of war being waged by the international community against Greek society. The international leaders don't see it that way, of course. They like to portray themselves as healers, administering a bitter but effective potion to a sickly economy. Yet the medicine they have prescribed can work only under ideal, even theoretical conditions. In the real world, Greeks are suffering horribly. Old people go hungry. Unemployment is at 25%, while youth unemployment is at 50%. The medicine is starting to look more and more like poison. From Hungary, why the border must be reinforced. It's awfully self-righteous of Europeans to criticize Hungary for building a border wall, said Marian Ripa. When Hungary announced it would put up a fence along its border with Serbia to block the illegal entry of migrants into the European Union, many EU newspapers condemned the plan as a new Iron Curtain. But let's be frank. The free movement of goods and people throughout the EU, the Union's greatest achievement and greatest economic strength, can only occur as long as the external borders are protected. If the outlying countries can't handle this task, internal borders will once again be policed. We are already seeing that happen along the Franco-Italian border, where French police have turned out in force to prevent the entry of thousands of refugees from Africa and the Middle East. We also know that reinforcing external borders works. The flow of migrants dropped when Greece tightened its Turkish border, and it dropped again when Bulgaria built a fence on its Turkish border. Of course, we all feel for the refugees. We wish we could give them all homes. But the already tight budgets of European governments have limits. If we let emotion prevail over reason, borderless Europe will be a thing of the past. And our international columns. First, Israel assigning blame for a bloody conflict. The United Nations has given Palestinians plenty of scope to charge Israel with war crimes, said Al-Quds in an editorial. In a report released this week, the UN Human Rights Council found that the brutal Israeli assault on Gaza last summer killed at least 2,100 Palestinians, nearly 1,500 of whom were civilians. The report slams Israel for its wholesale bombing of residential neighborhoods, saying the scale of the devastation was unprecedented. Most damningly, it cites Israeli attacks on UN-run schools where civilians were sheltering, places that should have been inviolable. But shockingly, the report also criticizes the Palestinian resistance. It forces an equivalence between the rockets Hamas fired at Israel and the bombing, massive bloodshed, and displacement of thousands of families by Israel. Children were terrorized on both sides, the report claims. Given that 557 Palestinian children were killed, compared with only 4 Israeli children, it's impossible to ignore the report's bias toward Israel. Actually, the report twists itself into knots trying to be even-handed, says Anshul Pfeffer in Haaretz. Israel didn't cooperate with the report because the inquiry was initially chaired by William Shabbas, an anti-Israel advocate so buffoonish as to lack all credibility. Shabbas eventually recused himself when it was found he had worked as a paid legal consultant for the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the inquiry passed into much abler hands. The report rightly faults Hamas for storing weapons in UN facilities, for summarily executing alleged collaborators, and for shooting thousands of rockets into Israeli civilian neighborhoods. Of course, the report is still inherently biased against Israel, in that no other conflict or military operation has ever been subjected to this level of legal scrutiny. The truth is, Israel did all it could to avoid civilian casualties, said the Jerusalem Post. Indeed, an international report on the Gaza war, sponsored by UN Watch, a Geneva-based NGO, found that Israel was so scrupulous in trying to avoid killing civilians that it put its own soldiers at greater risk. Such behavior exceeds the most exacting moral standards. Yet the UN still found a moral equivalence between Israel and Hamas, which deliberately targeted civilians. This is a bad omen for how Israel will be judged in the next war, said Ron Ben Yishai and Yedioth Abronoth. The UN is practically encouraging the use of human shields by holding Israel responsible for the deaths of Gaza civilians who were warned to leave their homes, yet stayed inside. What if a war comes with Hezbollah? The Iranian-backed militia has placed a considerable part of its heavy rockets and missiles inside houses in Lebanon. If Israel can't bomb the Lebanese houses that harbor Hezbollah militants and weapons, its ability to defend itself will be dangerously diminished. From South Korea, valuing national pride over lives. South Korea's obsession with its image abroad is like a collective mental illness, said Jason Lim. Earlier this month, lawmakers urged the government to raise the disease alert level from watch to warning as an outbreak of Middle East respiratory syndrome spread across the country. MERS has a 40% fatality rate, and Koreans need to be on their guard against it. But Health Minister Moon Hyung-pyo refused to raise the alert, saying that to do so would have a negative effect on Korea's national image. The government is afraid that tourists might stay home and the country's credit rating could take a hit. After all, it reasons, we've already spent a fortune on national branding, including nearly $2 million getting the second Avengers movie filmed in Seoul. We couldn't possibly let that go to waste, just to keep our citizens healthy. Almost no subject is immune from our national image disease. When parents of children who died in last year's Sewol ferry tragedy complained of government ineptitude, officials smeared them as money-hungry, shameless commie sympathizers who were tearing down South Korea's global image. Will that happen to those who warn of MERS? Let's not put saving face ahead of saving lives. From Brazil, silent on the abuses in Venezuela. Does Brazil's government understand how bad things are in Venezuela? Asked O Globo. Under President Nicolas Maduro, the country is moving toward a full dictatorship. The media is almost entirely controlled by the regime. Politicians and ordinary citizens who demonstrate against the government have been put into arbitrary detention, including, most egregiously, opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez, who is on a hunger strike. International human rights groups have denounced the arrests and the conditions in which detainees are being held. But South America's most important country has different concerns. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff just delivered an impassioned speech decrying the U.S. sanctions against Venezuela, saying they are unilateral measures aimed at promoting a coup. She finds these sanctions, imposed because of the regime's egregious human rights violations, more offensive than the very crimes they're intended to stop. Her government's official line is that Venezuela's treatment of its people is an internal matter, and that only the notoriously anti-American Union of South American Nations is qualified to speak about it. Rousseff's refusal to assume moral leadership on this continent is lamentable. Turn now to the last word, our in-depth article titled this week, A Child-Size Change of Heart. For years, I insisted I didn't want children, says Michelle Goldberg. But life is full of surprises. 12 years ago, I penned an essay for Salon.com series called To Breed or Not to Breed, about the decision to have children or not. It began this way. When I tell people that I'm 27, happily married, and that I don't think I ever want children, they respond one of two ways. Most of the time, they smile patronizingly and say, "You'll change your mind." Sometimes they do me the favor of taking me seriously, in which case they warn, "You'll regret it." The series inspired an anthology titled Maybe Baby. It was divided into three parts. No Thanks, Not For Me, On the Fence, and Taking the Leap. My essay was the first in the No section. So I felt a little sheepish when a year and a half ago, the writer Megan Daum asked me if I'd be interested in contributing to the book that would become Shallow, Selfish, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids. I wrote back to tell her that I couldn't. My son had just turned one. My transformation didn't begin with an unbidden outbreak of baby lust or a sudden longing for domesticity. It began, weirdly enough, when I learned about corpses becoming fathers. In 2011, I reported a piece for Tablet magazine about the strange Israeli campaign for posthumous reproduction. Israel is the world capital of reproductive technology, and a legal group called New Family wanted to give parents who had lost adult sons the right to extract their sperm and create grandchildren. I have mixed feelings about making dads out of dead men, but I remember being seized by the realization that if my husband were to die young, I'd want to be able to do it to him. Children, I suddenly understood, would hedge against the unthinkable fact of my husband's mortality. Not long ago, I learned the Arabic word yabuni from a friend's cheesy Facebook graphic. Literally, you bury me. It means wanting to die before a loved one so as not to have to face the world without him or her in it. It's a word that captures exactly my feeling for my husband. Part of the reason I didn't want kids was because I feared they'd come between us. But if he were gone, I'd be frantic to hold on to a piece of him. Grasping this didn't make me want a baby, exactly. But it started pushing me from the no to, well, ambivalent. My husband, Matt, was ambivalent, too. We were pleased with our two-person family, with our consuming careers, constant travel, and many tipsy nights out. All the things people say you lose when you become a parent. We met very young, the summer after my freshman year of college, and we'd never grown bored with each other. Sometimes we puzzled over what people meant when they said that marriage is hard work. We assumed it had something to do with parenthood. As happy as I am with my marriage, I'm not by nature a cheerful person. Like a lot of writers, I'm given to tedious bouts of anxiety, depression, and self-loathing. I am introverted and feel shattered if I don't have time alone every day. Worse, from a parental perspective, I am impatient, easily undone by quotidian frustrations. As much as I love to visit faraway places, I'm often reduced to tears by the indignities of air travel. When I'm stuck in a taxi in traffic, I unconsciously shred my cuticles until my fingers bleed. I pictured parenthood as a clammy, never-ending coach flight. Also, there was my work. As a little girl, I had never imagined myself with babies, or for that matter, with a husband. My vision of the future had involved an apartment in New York City, a cat, and a typewriter. I was sure children would get in the way of my ambitions, and worse, that I'd poison them with my resentment. I started looking online for stories about people who had children and then wished they hadn't. I read about a famous Ann Landers reader survey from the 1970s, undertaken in response to a letter from a young couple who feared, as I did, that parenthood would ruin their marriage. Will you please ask your readers the question, if you had to do it over again, would you have children, they asked. She did, and received 10,000 responses. To her dismay, 70% answered no. A 40-year-old mother of twins wrote, "I was an attractive, fulfilled career woman before I had these kids. Now I'm an exhausted, nervous wreck who misses her job and sees very little of her husband. He's got a friend, I'm sure, and I don't blame him. This helped shore up my faith in our decision." Looking back, the fact that my faith needed shoring up was a sign that something was changing. As I got older, the constant travel that once thrilled me became wearying. My work still meant a lot to me, but while I once thought that publishing a book would make me feel that I'd arrived, publishing too taught me that arrival is elusive. Where I'd once seen a family and intellectual life in opposition, Over time, I started worrying that it was an intellectual loss to go through life without experiencing something so fundamental to so many people's existence. Meanwhile, 35 was creeping up on me. Matt and I went back and forth, and back and forth some more. We both felt like we were atop a fulcrum and could be pushed either way if only the other knew what to do. At some point, we decided that I'd go off the pill and see what happened. For a few months, nothing did. I started to wonder if I were infertile, if biology had decided the issue for me. I wasn't sure if I was disappointed or relieved by this. Then, in a development that shocked me despite being completely predictable, I got pregnant and was immediately convinced I'd made an awful mistake. Within a couple of weeks, the queasiness came on like a portent, though at the same time I longed for the drinks I couldn't have. We had a trip coming up. My husband had work to do in London, and I was going to accompany him, then go to Israel and Palestine for work of my own. I wasn't sure how I'd get through it, but I was determined to go since it might be my last chance to travel for a very long time. The first few days in London, I cried constantly. Then, one afternoon, I called my doctor in New York for the results of some routine tests. The news wasn't good. My progesterone was low, which the doctor said could either be a cause or symptom of a failing pregnancy. When we got off the phone, I was hysterical with worry over this pregnancy that I didn't want at all. Back in New York, I went immediately to the doctor, shaking as I waited to see the result of my 10-week ultrasound. When I saw the beating heart of the ghostly, paisley-shaped creature, I was, for all my qualms, hugely thankful. Over the next 2 weeks, I started to get a little bit excited about the baby. It helped that the sickness and sleepiness had lifted. When I returned to the doctor at 12 weeks, the end of my first trimester, and the danger zone for pregnancy lost, I was almost relaxed. But this time, the ultrasound showed no heartbeat. I had never felt as sad about anything as I did about that miscarriage. Actually, sad isn't the right word, since it suggests a watercolor melancholy. And this was jagged, putrid desolation. The only way to make the anguish disappear, I thought, was to get pregnant again. Before, I'd been baffled by some women's animal desperation for a baby. Now that desperation took hold of me. It took 5 months for me to get pregnant again, not a very long time, though it felt endless, and makes me sorry for those condemned to spend years in that hideous limbo. I white-knuckled it through much of the pregnancy, terrified of seeing a still heart at each ultrasound. Perhaps it says something about my pre-baby life that a lot of my metaphors for new motherhood were drug-related. Those endless hours my son and I spent in bed, alternately nursing, dozing, and staring, amazed at each other, reminded me of the time I'd smoked opium in Thailand. Lugging him around on errands brought to mind the first few times I got stoned as a teenager, when during normal things like going to school or the drugstore became complicated, strange, and full of misadventure. The oxytocin felt like ecstasy. Why, I kept thinking, hadn't anyone told me how great this was? It was a stupid thing to think, because in fact people tell you that all the time. In general, though, the way people describe having a baby is much like the way they describe marriage, as a sacrifice that's worth it, as a rewarding challenge, as a step toward growing up. Nobody had told me it would be fun. The fact that it was, of course, was largely a matter of my good fortune and privilege. Getting what a friend of mine calls the good hormones instead of those that cause postpartum debilitation is largely a matter of dumb luck. I also had a husband who was a full, enthusiastic partner, an established, flexible career, and, crucially, money to afford good child care. My son was, and is, sweet-natured and easy. Certainly, it sucked sometimes. A purple-clad lactation consultant prescribed a regimen of round-the-clock feeding, pumping, and tea-guzzling that, had I followed it, would have broken me in a day. Her visit left me feeling crushed, inadequate, and then humiliated for not having stood up to her. I'd worried throughout my pregnancy that I would resent my son for taking me away from my work. Instead, I resented my work from taking me away from my son, which created its own sort of identity crisis. For all that, though, my son's first year was the best of my life. I learned that while travel with a baby isn't easy, it's doable. We took him to Malaysia, where I was speaking at a conference when he was 6 months old, and then on a reporting trip to Panama a few months later. Both of these were countries we'd been to before. Seeing them again with our son made travel feel new. He made staying home feel new, too. When I was with him, the habitual churning of my mind eased. Instead of arguing with strangers on Twitter, I spent hours in neighborhood parks I'd barely noticed before. Ultimately, even my work life improved. The crisis motherhood brought on led me to refocus on more satisfying long-form writing. Something Louis C.K. said recently was true for me. Quote, I realized that a lot of the things that my kid was taking away from me, she was freeing me of. Matt and I were so delighted by our baby that we started half-seriously mulling a second. I was now in my late 30s and assumed that if and when we resolved to go for it, it would take even longer than before. One night, thinking we needn't work so hard to prevent a pregnancy that we might soon wish for, we didn't use birth control. In the morning, we came to our senses, decided we weren't ready, and vowed not to be so sloppy again. It was too late. Our daughter was born 9 months later, almost 2 years to the day after her brother. She is a wonder, but having two children in diapers actually is pretty hard, particularly when you live in a fourth-floor walk-up. There are evenings when my husband and I are too harried to say more than a few words to each other as we tag-team two bedtimes and then collapse in front of the television. I'm occasionally incredulous that I've ended up with exactly the sort of life I once publicly pledged to avoid. Unlike Ann Lander's survey respondents, I swear I don't regret it, though sometimes I'm mortified when I think about how my 27-year-old self would regard the frazzled, stroller-pushing woman I am now. I try to figure out how to explain myself in a way that would be intelligible to her, but I don't think I can. The best I can come up with is that before, there was one person in the world for whom I would use the word yabberni. Now there are three. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in nymag.com. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The talent spotter who discovered comedy greats, Jack Rollins, 1915 to 2015. One day in the late 1950s, a young Woody Allen walked into Jack Rollins' Manhattan office and asked the comedy manager to represent him as a TV writer. Rollins, whose client list would go on to include David Letterman, Robin Williams, and Billy Crystal, knew talent when he saw it. He signed Allen, encouraged him to focus on stand-up, and helped him perfect his comic timing and inflection. For the first 18 months, Rollins recalled, Allen was the worst comedian you can possibly imagine. But then Allen started to improve. He got a smile, then a laugh, and then a cult, said Rollins. The comedian stayed loyal to Rollins for decades, listing him as a producer on his films long after his manager had retired. "Without Jack," said Allen, "I wouldn't have a career." Born in Brooklyn, Rollins got his start in show business after World War II as a Broadway producer, said the New York Times. But it was a struggle, and in 1951 he founded a talent agency in Midtown Manhattan. His long-term business partner, Charles Jaffe, joined the company the following year. One of his first clients was Harry Belafonte, then a struggling singer and short order cook. He suggested Belafonte give up pop songs and sing calypso and folk music that reflected his Caribbean heritage, and the singer quickly became a sensation. Rollins' roster soon filled up with comedians he'd spotted in Greenwich Village clubs, including Lenny Bruce and the groundbreaking duo Mike Nichols and Elaine May. In the late 1970s, Rollins signed Robin Williams, bringing order and structure to the former street mime's somewhat chaotic performances, said Variety.com. He also helped Williams score his breakout role on TV's Mork and Mindy. Known for taking on only a few clients at a time, Rollins eventually focused on just one, David Letterman, said the Los Angeles Times. He was an executive producer on Letterman's Late Show for 10 years before retiring in 1992. Despite his influence on comedy, Rollins was notoriously bad at telling jokes, a shortcoming he happily acknowledged. "I have a talent," he said, "for noticing other talent." We'll take in one of the book reviews this week. This is their book of the week, How Music Got Free: The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy by Stephen Witt from Viking Books. Stephen Witt's nimble new book tells a story you may think you know, said Dwight Garner in the New York Times. The development of the MP3 kicked off a global wave of illegal file sharing about 15 years ago that has upended almost everything about how music is distributed, consumed, and stored. Yet Witt, a young journalist, brings fresh reporting to bear and complicates things in terrific ways. He presents the rise of music piracy and the end of the old order as neither spontaneous nor inevitable, but rather the product of individual choices, both savvy and foolish. Three main characters, a pioneering German engineer, a pilfering plant worker, and an embattled record company executive, carry Witt's account, giving the reader a log seat in the entire digital music revolution. "The surprises in this book come thick and fast," said Nick Hornby in the Sunday Times. "Who knew that Karlheinz Brandenburg, the Frankfurt engineer who created the MP3 format, made his millions only because hackers found the encoding software online and used it to create a global market in stolen music? Brandenburg understood the risk of piracy well enough to warn record executives in 1997. But the industry, flush from the sale of CDs, brushed off his concerns. Meanwhile, Del Glover, a low-level employee at a CD pressing plant in North Carolina, was about to open the floodgates. Around 1999, Glover began smuggling out pre-release CDs for a hacker collective that would eventually pirate 20,000 albums. Glover made $1,500 a week from his efforts, but How Music Got Free is mainly a tale of money lost. From 2000 to 2007, the music industry shrank by half." The book's title hints that the upheaval benefited music in the long run, but this is where Witt's curiosity fails, said Carl Wilson in Book Forum. He's sympathetic to Doug Morris, a record exec associated with the major label's slow, self-defeating response to piracy. Yet nowhere does Witt discuss how file sharing broadened listener taste and touched off a revival of amateur music, making not seen since the days of the parlor piano. Actually, musicians have been hurt the most by piracy and its after effects, said Stephen Poole in The Guardian. Streaming services like Spotify now provide listeners free, legal access to songs. But the service's fraction of a penny payouts deny many artists the chance to make a living. And the Fat Cat executives, they continue to do very nicely, thank you. We are on the Making Money page now with the article, Retirement, When to File for Social Security. Don't know much about Social Security? You're definitely not alone, said Kevin McCornelly in Kiplinger.com. MassMutual Life Insurance recently tested 1,500 Americans on 10 basic true-false facts about the federal retirement program. The results were not encouraging. More than 70% of respondents flunked, and just one person answered every question correctly. These weren't trick questions either. Asked to identify the full retirement age, when full benefits can be collected, more than two-thirds of the respondents answered 65. That was once true, but Congress abandoned it 30 years ago. Today, it's 66, and for those born in 1960 or later, it's 67. Only 57% of respondents knew that the age at which you claim benefits affects the size of your checks. When to start taking Social Security benefits is one of the most important financial decisions most of us will make, said Alan Sloan in the Washington Post. If you or a spouse has worked at least 10 years, you can start drawing benefits at any time between the ages of 62 and 70. The longer you wait to start, the bigger your monthly benefit. Today, if you begin collecting at full retirement age, you get 100% of your benefit. It rises about 8% each year you wait and shrinks by about that much for starting early. So at age 62, you get 75% of your monthly benefit, and at age 70, you get 132%. Delaying Social Security is often wise for singles, said Ilana Polyak in CNBC.com. It's not so straightforward for married couples who are confronted with more than 8,000 different ways they might claim Social Security benefits. Couple with a big earnings discrepancy between them should consider the file and suspend strategy. The higher-earning spouse files for his or her benefits at full retirement age and then immediately suspends it to allow the benefit to grow. The other spouse then claims a spousal benefit, which is half of the filer's benefit. This allows couples to collect partial benefits without waiting to take advantage of the full amount later. There are many, many exceptions to all this well-intentioned Social Security advice, said Philip Moeller in Time.com. While you might know that the earliest age retirement benefits start at 62, there are benefits that can start sooner. Survivor's benefits may be taken as young as age 60. Disability insurance benefits can be triggered at any age. The Social Security Administration provides a questionnaire on its website to help people understand which benefits they are entitled to. Just remember, this is not a one-size-fits-all program. Shielding heirs from taxes. Your death could be more taxing than you imagine, said Jonathan Clements in the Wall Street Journal. If you die owning traditional retirement accounts like a 401k or IRA, your heirs still have to pay the income taxes owed on withdrawals. These accounts are typically the second largest asset owned by families approaching retirement age. To protect your heirs, you might shelve the standard advice for retirees, which is to tap taxable accounts first. That's because the value of an asset like a stock that has appreciated in value will automatically rise to its current value at your death for tax purposes, which could eliminate a capital gains tax bill. Or you might convert part of your traditional retirement accounts to a Roth IRA, where it will grow tax-free. We'll finish up this second reading of the July 3rd, 2015 issue of the Week magazine on the business page. We'll start with the news at a glance. Healthcare. Insurers battle over mega merger. Health insurance giant Anthem is pushing hard for a merger with rival Cigna, said Kevin McCoy in USA Today. The Indianapolis-based insurer has made four takeover offers for its slightly smaller competitor over the past month. The most recent, a $47.5 billion bid. And Cigna has rejected all of them. Anthem executives have responded by taking the previously secret negotiations public, hoping to rally Cigna shareholders to their side. Whether this latest jockeying will lead to what would be the biggest U.S. health insurance merger ever remains to be seen. Among Cigna's objections, antitrust lawsuits against Anthem, and questions over who would head the combined firm. Everyone wondered what Obamacare would do to the health insurance business, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. Now we know. Consolidation on a huge scale. Just in the past few weeks, the nation's five largest health insurers have been in a round robin of merger talks. In addition to Anthem's bid for Cigna, United Health Group is courting Aetna, and Aetna and Cigna have each made overtures to Humana. With the Affordable Care Act effectively capping health insurers' profits, companies are scrambling to achieve bigger scale in hopes of generating higher margins. Will consumers benefit? The prevailing view is not promising. Amazon rewards page turners. Amazon has a plot twist in store for writers, said Peter Wehner in TheAtlantic.com. Beginning July 1st, the online retailer will pay authors who self-publish on its ebook platform by the number of pages a Kindle user actually reads, instead of the number of times a book is downloaded. The author of a 100-page book downloaded 100 times and read completely through will now make the same amount as the author of a 200-page book downloaded 100 times but only half read. Authors won't be able to cheat with huge lettering or spaces between sentences. Pages will be standardized to make payments fair. It hasn't escaped writers that a system with per-page payouts is a system that rewards cliffhangers and mysteries. Book fans, take note. You have many ticking time bombs, unexplained plans, and secrets to be revealed later in your reading future. Media. Martha Stewart sells her lifestyle empire. Martha Stewart's once mighty media and merchandising company just sold for a near clearance price, said John Kell in Fortune.com. Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia, valued at nearly $2 billion when it went public in 1999, was acquired this week for $353 million by Sequential Brands Group. Sequential, which buys brands and licenses them out for a fee, also owns stakes in Jessica Simpson's clothing collection and Heely's wheeled footwear. Stewart's beleaguered company has reported annual losses for five straight years, dragged down by declining ad revenue at its magazines and discontinued merchandising deals. Olive Garden lifts Darden restaurants. Olive Garden has investors satiated, said Paul R. LaMonica in CNN.com. Parent company Darden Restaurants reported impressive results in the latest quarter, sending its shares to an all-time high. Executives credited a 12% uptick in sales at its Italian-themed chain, which accounts for more than half of Darden's business. Since October, the company made a slew of changes to the chain's operation, rolling out new menu items and marketing, all in response to demands by activist hedge firm Starboard Value Partners. Tough new regulations in the UK require senior bankers to wait as long as 7 years before collecting annual bonuses. The rules are meant to prevent the excessive risk-taking blamed for the 2008 financial crisis and follow recent scandals involving the rigging of global interest rates at UK banks. Asia will account for 53% of the world's economy by 2050, up from 32% today, according to a forecast by the Economist Intelligence Unit. China, the U.S., and India are expected to be the world's three largest economies, each larger than the next five biggest economies combined. If you want to get an MBA, aim to graduate just before you turn 30. The average starting salary for a new B-school graduate increases sharply throughout his or her 20s, from less than $80,000 at age 24 to more than $125,000 at age 30, according to analysis at Bloomberg. Then it drops steadily, falling to $110,000 by age 36. Workers spend 200 hours annually on their commute, paying nearly $2,600 on average, according to a survey by Citibank. That's about $10 per day. People in Los Angeles report the most expensive round-trip daily cost, 16, followed by New Yorkers at 14 and Chicagoans at 11. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.